The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Room to improve, new bill to give tenants more rights. Courting trouble, will Ireland be sued by corporations under CETA? And prudence or payback, what do you want to see in the budget? All that and more coming up on tonight's Late Debate. And joining us in studio to debate all of that, we have Marco Cossack, Green Party TD for Waterford, and Marie Sherlock, Labour Senator for Dublin Central, Harry McGee, political correspondent with the Irish Times, and joining us remotely tonight, we have Breed Smith, People Before Profit TD for Dublin South Central. Now, we want to hear from you as well, so do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie, or tweet to @latedebate_RTE. Well, housing was on the agenda again earlier today as Labour TD Ivana Bacik tabled the Tenants' Rights Bill. And before we get into the detail of this legislation, I just want us to have a listen to just two of the callers who phoned in to Liveline on this issue today. We'll start with Jessica. She described how she got a notice to quit the accommodation she had rented for 15 years because her landlord wanted to refurbish it.
I've been couch surfing ever since. I have an excellent reference from the landlord. Haven't had an opportunity to show it to anybody in 2 years because there's just simply nowhere to rent. I've been on the housing list for 10 years, so I have been left couch surfing for a year. And like most people my age, I'm in my 50s now, like most people my age, you know, there's no family home, my parents are gone, there's just nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go to kind of say, okay, well, I'm not really homeless. I can go back to home when there's something, when something's really bad. I'm only in my 50s now. I'm heading into old age with this. And so is everybody who, this is the rental market. Even people listening now, they're in their 20s and 30s, that, ah, this has nothing to do with me. This is heading down the track for you too.
And then there was Sandra, who has found herself in her early 50s, living in a shed with no running water in someone's garden.
This country is not fulfilling its care of duty for people. No. It's not good.
Yeah, I think that says it all, really. Be honest.
And it's very hard to talk about because there's so much shame involved in it and you feel so dispossessed. And there's no hope. There's no hope anymore.
There is no hope. There's no hope anymore. That was Sandra there. I think anyone who heard that programme today, you know, you'd have to be moved by the plight that, that people, particularly people in that situation, older people, single people, find themselves in. And, you know, there is no hope for those people. Well, let's talk first, Marie, about that bill that Ivana Bacik introduced today. What's that? What will that do for people in that situation?
Well, I think the first thing to say, Katie, is like listening to those two callers today, there's two things that stand out. Like day in, day out as public representatives, we're dealing with people who are 10, 15 years on housing waiting lists in Dublin and other parts of the country, and they're going to be waiting many more years to get a house because of the such a few number of houses that are available for social housing. And the second thing is, you know, often we talk about renting as being a young person's problem. It's not. And there's lots of people who are now facing into retirement and still renting. And of course, we know that our pension system, it's not designed for those who are renting. It's really stark to hear those contributors today. So the bill that Ivana Bacik brought forward in the Dáil today and published along with Senator Rebecca Moynihan, who's the Labour Party's housing spokesperson, I suppose sought to do three things. Firstly, restrict the circumstances in which a landlord can actually terminate a tenancy or evict a tenant. And often, you know, I suppose on a regular basis, we have stories of landlords wanting to evict a tenant on the basis that a relative wants to move in. And that now is being restricted to, you know, a spouse or a child. But secondly, as well, on the grounds of a landlord wanting to sell within 3 months, that has been restricted as well, because ultimately, we need to put in place a system whereby tenants have some certainty with regards to their tenure, and there has to be very genuine reasons why a landlord wants to effectively evict a tenant. The second key part of the legislation today is with regards to I suppose what we might call a register of rents. So at the moment, somebody going out to try and rent an apartment or a house, they have no idea as to what the previous rent was. They have no idea of the previous tenancies or duration.
So it's the idea that this would be publicly available.
Absolutely. And that we would bring transparency to the renting process. And the third thing then is with regards to the quality of accommodation. And, you know, just I know some people were kind of smiling when we talked about like the ban on pets that many landlords impose. But I'm dealing with a family at the moment who've got a four-year-old boy with autism, and he used to have a dog in the apartment. And the landlord said, no, you have to get rid of the dog. And the setback that that has brought on that family and to that child, that four-year-old autistic boy, because he does not have his dog. And it's medically proven that having a dog for some autistic children is really important.
Okay.
So actually changing those rules now to actually make renting a much more viable option for
okay,
people.
So this is a Labour bill. The government today said they won't oppose it. Are we?
That's correct.
So we're embracing all the elements of this bill. Will.
I think what the idea here is by allowing it to proceed to the next stage, it'll undergo the pre-legislative scrutiny that PMB bills get after being passed to the second stage.
Now, we've seen a load stage of those that were allowed to go to the next stage only to be, you know...
Yeah, absolutely. But what I'd say is I think this government is approaching good quality PMBs with an open mind.
Private members' bills.
And it has to be said that the government has no monopoly on wisdom or no monopoly on good ideas. Now, there is a context for this as well, because the government will be bringing forward the Housing and Residential Tenancies Bill itself this year. So there's a context whereby we are moving in the direction where we want to strengthen renters' rights and tenancies of indefinite duration in particular, which is what Maria is talking about. And moving to what you could describe as a more mature rental market, where people can stay in their rented accommodation for longer, people can make a way of life in it. We've also through the...
But what do you do then when you retire, like the Sandras and the Jessicas?
Yeah, so affordable rentals is a big part of that equation. And so, for example, the cost rental model, that was one of the main things that was in the Housing for All document, which is a Green Party measure. It's about trying to bring us to that kind of more mature rental market, as I say, whereby people can stay in rented accommodation for a longer period of time. And most importantly, at an affordable rent point, so that it's an option for people who may not be able to buy their own home. Of course, we have to expand
affordable and social housing. Absolutely transform the rental market if we are to have a situation where somebody, say, on a state old age pension could possibly afford to pay a rent and survive as well.
I think we have to substantially reform the entire housing system. And I think the Housing for All document, it's been described as one of the most ambitious pieces of housing policy to come in the history of the state. So it's about providing social and affordable housing. It's about providing cost rental okay.
I just want to bring Breed in because she's not here. Breed, can I tell people why you're not joining us tonight in studio? Have we got Breed on the line? We're not hearing Breed now at the moment. Can you hear us, Breed? I'm going to go to Harry. Oh, the line has gone down there. We'll bring Breed in a minute. Yeah, I'll have you all on tenderhooks for Breed's.
We have a problem. Who's Houston for the moment?
Sorry, Harry. Yeah, this legislation, is it going to, first of all, you know, we've seen a lot of bills that are not opposed by the government. This is just the latest of a long list. But a lot of those bills go nowhere ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, it was accepted by the government, and I think a lot of the suggestions contained in the bill are practical. I think they would address the issues that were brought up by the two callers on Liveline today. When Ivana Bacik talked about the bill on the plinth yesterday, Katie, she was talking about landlords putting onerous conditions on tenants, asking, for example, for professional cleaners to come in order that the tenant would be able to recover their deposit, which is a disgrace. And what we heard today on Liveline was also disgraceful. In common with all of the other opposition parties, the bill also calls for an effective freeze on rents for a period of 3 years. And that really is to respond to what the government's suggestion is, that they're trying to peg rent increases to inflation, particularly in the rent protected zones around the country. But the problem is that inflation is not exactly soaring at the moment, but it is increasing at a worrying rate. And the opposition has said that it's not a freeze, really. What we're seeing is that rent is going up. And the other thing politically that has stoked an awful lot of controversy over the past 24 hours were the comments by the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, relation to the respective rights of tenants and landlords, where he made a pitch on behalf of the landlords and invited a lot of criticism.
Okay, do you know what? I think we actually have that clip and we can play it, and then I think we can go to Breed. We got the clip with the Taoiseach yesterday speaking on the affordable housing debate, and this is in relation to the conflicting tensions between tenants and landlords.
And one person's rent is another person's income, might be their pension, might be how they pay the mortgage. And in a time of rising prices and in a time of rising interest rates, and that will come, hasn't come yet, but it will come, if you freeze rents absolutely to zero, that could mean an income cut for another person, a pension cut for another person, or another person unable to pay the mortgage on that property.
Right, and that was the Taoiseach speaking in the Dáil yesterday. Breed, have we got you back?
You do. Can you hear me now?
Yes, perfectly, Breed Smith. Thank you very much.
Grand.
You're indisposed.
I broke my leg at the beginning of the summer. I had a great summer lying in bed. I had a bad break and surgery, but I'm getting better. It's not going to kill me. I just want to comment on the discussion here. Look, first of all, I welcome the bill, but I do think it's very limited, and an indication that it is as limited as that the government are saying they're not going to oppose it. Because anything that goes beyond the limits of the market or goes beyond the very limited vision that the government have for solving a crisis is rejected and opposed straight away. Just to say that I think this is a piecemeal approach and doesn't go far enough. And I say that because we've just been through a crisis where we managed to ban evictions on everybody. Nobody could be evicted because we had a COVID crisis. And that was a very good thing. And that was supported by the Oireachtas in general. But we're in a housing crisis. And those stories today, and I heard them on Drive Time last week, are the hardest stories to listen to. Months ago, we were listening to homeless families. We were listening to lone parents. Before that, we're listening to men sleeping in their cars. Every time we reach a pinnacle in this crisis, we hear the most heart-rending stories of a crisis that is gripping people's basic rights. You have a right to food, you have a right to shelter, you have a right to a health service, but we are not meeting those rights. And I have to say, and you know, I'm not trying to have a go at Ivana or indeed the senator in the studio, Labour have a responsibility for this. Under Alan Kelly's housing policy, he did his best to encourage in corporate landlordism in the shape of real estate agency companies. He also allowed the wholesale strategy of social housing to be put into HAP, which is not appropriate and doesn't fulfil our need. It ends up spending billions of the Exchequer funding on subsidising landlords. We need a radical approach to this crisis. The bill is good, I welcome it, but it is not radical enough to deal with those heart-rending stories that we're hearing time and time and time again.
Yeah, do you want to respond to that in particular, Labour's?
You see, I think to us the clear thing is we need to have urgent action now, right? And Breed can, you know, make all the sideswipes she wants about something that happened 10 years ago. And just to say, like, as an Alan Kelly put enormous funding into social housing at that time, more than any minister prior to that. But the key issue now is that we actually see change, because with housing, people are fed up day in, day out. They're listening to promises about what we're going to do into the future, how we're going to help people get housing into the future, and, you know, housing for all and the change that it's going to bring somewhere down the line. People need change now, and that's why we have designed this bill, so that the government, you know, hopefully will push this through the Oireachtas and people will actually see immediate impact in their lives, not something 6 months' time, a year down the line, or even further. And that's and a space
would,
yeah, for it.
I would say it might be limited in its scope, the bill, but it is a piece of private members' business and is necessarily limited in its scope.
Can I ask you about the Taoiseach's remarks there that Harry mentioned and has created quite a lot of chatter online and I think in the real world as well. And I just see, as you said that, we got a message in here. Landlords have rights too. Whose property is it anyway? We're not a communist dictatorship yet.
We're not a communist dictatorship yet, no. I wouldn't take the position that somebody's rent should be covering somebody else's mortgage. I wouldn't be of that position. However, what I would say is we do have an issue with people leaving the rental market, in terms of landlords leaving the rental market, is 3,500 have done so since 2019. And that's contributing as well to the tightness of the rental landscape. So there is a problem there. But let's call a spade, if your rent is paying somebody else's mortgage, you're paying the mortgage.
We say that, we talk about those landlords and we talk about the mom and pop landlords in particular, people that might have maybe one or two properties for various reasons, some to do with the housing.
70% have one property, and I think 85%, 86% have either one or two properties.
Yes, but of course, a huge number, something like almost 50% of people have landlords who have much more than that. Yeah. You know, so it's not that most people are living in properties owned by just one, with landlords who have just one.
No,
or two
and
properties.
I think
that's important too, because I think
landlords,
people play around with these numbers quite a lot when they're talking about this.
And I think larger professional landlords are often better placed, in fact, to be able to provide a service to their tenants. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, but in relation to when we talk about.
Can I just.
Yes, Bree.
Katie, can I just make a comment on all of this? I mean, I thought what the Times just said yesterday was quite typical. Deflect from the issue by choosing a cohort that is not representative of what's really going on in society. But just to respond to the Labour senator there, look, just to respond to you, when we talk about the sort of radical action that is needed, for example, when you talk about putting a freeze on rents, actually we need much more because rents have gone out of control over the last 10 years. And the first bill I introduced back in 2016 was actually to put a freeze on rents, but bring the rents back to 2011 levels when we were coming out of the crash. And at that point, then introduce the rent pressure zones, rejected utterly by the government and by all the other parties. And later on, I think it was Simon Coveney at the time, introduced rent pressure zones, but allowed the market to have its day. And the problem is that this government, on every issue, whether it's climate change, whether it's transport, whether it's housing, no matter what the fundamentals are, it's market reliance. It's market dictated. It's not dictated by certain sensible social policies that will meet people's human rights. And we're denying those people their basic human rights. And it's tragic. And it's outrageous. And I don't forgive the Labour Party for what they did 10 years ago. It's great to see you're taking a different tack. But they did actually contribute to this problem, as did Fianna Fáil, as did Fine Gael, and all of those who participated in the governments for the last 10 to 12 years.
That issue that Breed mentioned there, and it was something that came in around the time that Alan Kelly was in the Department of Housing, the wholesale use of HAP and taking people off the housing list by saying you are now appropriately housed, and what that has done to the private rental market. It's indisputable that was.
We have had 10 years, right, of an opportunity for governments after the Labour Fine Gael government 2011 to 2016. Like, because we've had it's not 10 years, but we've had 6 years, right, of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael being able to change the system if they so wished, and they did not. In fact, there's 700 million euros of state funding put into HAP now. When HAP was originally set up, it was tiny and it was only intended as a short-term measure. But it has been made permanent by Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, right? And the key issue now is we don't see any prospect anytime soon of being weaned off that. But just to go back to another point.
Sorry, so you're saying that when HAP was introduced, it was intended
Of course, to take over from rent supplement is a short-term measure. Ultimately, the Labour Party has always believed that the state needs to be building houses, right? And we believe that in government. And remember, we were in the middle of a recession and the Troika at the time. So trying to find the resource for that was enormously difficult. But the key issue now is that we need the local authorities, we need the state to be building houses. And so Breed and I don't disagree in terms of what the state needs to be doing, right? But in terms of the bill that we have here today, you know, and let's bring it back to that, we need urgent action. I think another important point to make, Katie, is with regards to the Taoiseach's comments yesterday, right? And he seems to be suggesting that a landlord and generating income from rent is like any other business or rent generating activity. And it's not like any other stock or share. It's about a person's home, and we need to rebalance the complete power imbalance between a landlord and a tenant. This is not just any type of business. This is about people's homes, and with that there needs to be landlord responsibility.
I saw that being referred to today, Harry, as saying the quiet bit out loud in terms of, you know, that acknowledgement that who was he talking to there?
I missed that particular quote. Just
the quote you were talking about that Leo Varadkar said yesterday in relation to one person's rent is another person's.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think he was talking about small landlords and those that Mark referred to that had one property or perhaps two properties. Now, actually, I was very interested in the point that Breed was making there, talking about pegging rent back to 2011 values. It would be interesting to see what kind of profit margin that landlords are making at present from renting out properties, because I was talking to a colleague who was trying to get a one-bedroom flat in Dublin, and she was saying that it was going to cost her €1,800 a month, which is more than most people pay outside Dublin for a mortgage for a 3 or 4 bedroom property, way more than they do. So there is a basic imbalance and inequality there.
I haven't heard, apart from Breed saying there we should just do it, but I mean, I haven't seen any suggestions or policies or proposals from anyone who's saying that we to bring rents down. I mean, people are kind of saying we need to peg rents now, but
I don't believe it'll be legal.
I don't
think it'd be legally possible for us to force rents down, as much as it might be desirable. And I absolutely accept Harry's point as well.
People have to accept now that this is where we are, and that really, you can use the word extortion to what people are being asked to pay in many circumstances.
Absolutely, and the solution is to build.
And that's where we are, and there's no way, we just have to wait for wages to catch up with that.
Solution is to build, and I think the cost rental model, that's a large part of that is to provide a handbrake on the rental market. But I thought it was interesting that Marie mentioned that, you know, when Labour were in government, said what we need to do is build, and then said, well, when Labour was in government, we didn't build. Now, I accept that we were in the midst of a financial crisis. But the problem about built stock is it takes an awful long time to generate. And so we have a huge problem that's built up.
Can I just come in?
Just let Mark finish this point. I'll bring you in then.
The solution to a rental crisis or a housing crisis is more built stock. But that isn't a quick fix. We can't turn that around in a short space of time. The Housing for All document lays out the government strategy for moving in that direction. The cost rental, which I think is a central plank of that.
But look at what we have built. Look at what we have built. And that neatly brings me to the next point this evening, the whole issue of student accommodation. And, you know, what have we used the limited capacity we have for building? And one of the things we used it for in the last number of years was building student accommodation, which is at enormous cost but no student I know could possibly afford the prices that a lot of that high-end student accommodation has been. I'll let you in, Breed. You wanted to respond to Mark there.
And yeah, I do want to come in on the whole question of build. I mean, people like Mel Reynolds and other good alternative type architects and thinkers have pointed out to us repeatedly that this country is full of empty properties. Between the two canals in Dublin, there's about 20,000 empty properties that could be converted and retrofitted and put into decent flats and homes.
And yet, sorry to cut across your brief, there was a report that came out from the Department of Finance, I think, on this, which suggested that there would not be any vacant tax levy wouldn't make much of an impact on the housing market, because there wasn't when they went looking for them. They couldn't find vacant. Harry?
You see, the problem is there, and I have examples of it here just up the road from where I live, and I don't live in a lucrative area. I live in Ballyfermot. Vacant properties have vacant tax levies on them, but they're not collected. They're not enforced, and the tax levies are very, very low. But my point here would be, if we're in the middle of a housing crisis, and if property owners are leaving vast quantities of property lying empty for years and years, like that hotel outside of Galway, with a couple of hundred that's then, and the developers...
Okay, that line is breaking down again.
She's talking about the Corrib Bay, southern outside Galway, which is my home city. And, I mean, yes, that could be redeveloped, but you're talking... When you talk about redevelopment, you're not talking about let's throw lots of money out of it and we'll you know, create 300 flats or what have you. You're talking about a process that will not be coate or finished for another 4 or 5 years at the very least. And that's notwithstanding objections, planning difficulties, problems with finance and what have you. So I think Mark was correct. Everybody's correct. When you talk about housing, it's a simple equation. We have the demand and we don't have the supply at the moment. But to get the supply is very difficult. And different governments have been wrestling with it for over a decade now. And we still haven't seen a solution. In relation to vacant houses, that is one part of a solution. But it is not the silver bullet that has been presented by some. In Louth County Council, for example, they went after derelict properties. They got CPOs done to get them back. It involved a huge amount of work, and they did bring some properties back to the market. But you kind of have to wonder.
But it's not just about derelict. But Harry, it's not just about derelict property. We know that there are properties that are being kept vacant in order to inflate the price.
Of course, there is potential there, but it's only one piece of a very, very complicated jigsaw.
Okay, go back to the issue of student accommodation, because this is huge. I've just seen a text coming in here. My son has just moved to Galway to start college. We spent about 6 years looking for suitable accommodation. The prices are ridiculous. Where do they think students are going to get the money? And I saw the Dublin Inquirer reporting today that the number of beds have been redesignated as short-term lets, which would suggest that there is accommodation available. But... they're being allowed to use them for short-term lets.
So basically, we're being told...
Let Marie there, and I'll bring you in then, Breeze.
So we've been told repeatedly, and indeed we have many accounts of it into our own office, of students who cannot afford some of the rents being charged by accommodation operators in Dublin. And we have a situation, particularly in the area that I'm based in, Dublin 1 and Dublin 7, where there's currently 987 beds, right, that can be rented out now to either students, tourists or short-term lets. So it's co-living by the back door. And student operators have gone to Dublin City Council and on board Pinola, because we've appealed to on board Pinola, and said, there isn't enough demand. We need to bring in tourists or short-term lets to try and shore up our income. And of course, what should be happening is Dublin City Council should be turning that down and saying, actually, you need to look at your prices. And what's happening here is the planning system is allowing student accommodation operators to charge €250 plus per week and get away with it, because they're now able to open it up to other people. So we have student accommodation operators that have is an availability in our area at the moment, and there are students crying out. And you know, when you look at the SUSE grant, that if you get 100% of the adjacent grant, it'll only cover less than 3 months student accommodation in some of the operations,
so
particularly in
Dublin.
This is
a huge barrier, obviously, to a lot of people who live outside the city.
Absolutely huge. But the planning authorities are allowing the planning system to be used and abused to cushion operators against future losses, and that should never be the intent of the planning system. It should be to shape future to communities for the future.
Yeah, Breed Smith.
Well, again, I'll just repeat the point that when you see housing as a commodity, as something to make vast profits out of, then everything is geared towards facilitating that and towards the markets rather than the need. That Dublin Inquirer thing you referred to there, Katie, the report today indicated that Dublin City Council freed up, allowed them to use 1,300 student accommodation beds for one-off use for tourists, even for happy.
I have it here. The Dublin City Council granted planning permission to student accommodation providers in the city to allow them to convert as many as 1,055 student beds to be used as short-term
beds
up to May of next year.
Exactly. So that's a big hole. Now, as far as I know, the students are having a sleep outside the Dáil overnight over this, because it is a real, real serious crisis for them. And as if they hadn't been through enough over the last year and a half, being away from college, being away from their pals, and the ones that are starting off haven't come out of their leaving cert. I mean, it's outrageous what goes on, and it is all about the profit of the landowners, of the developers, of the hoteliers, of the big businesses that build and develop these places. Down the road from me in Dublin 8, the whole place is destroyed with student accommodation, the little bed sits that created in big blocks, the hotels. A lot of it is empty, but most of it is way too expensive for anybody from the area to be able to afford, or I'd imagine anybody from Cork City or Galway or anybody going to college in Dublin.
Okay.
So it's a huge crisis. And
I just want to put that to Mark. And I just, the Taoiseach was asked about this in New York today. And he said that there are limits to what the government can do to resolve this student accommodation crisis.
There's a Labour Party bill to actually curb the conversion of student accommodation to any other use. But anyway, go on.
Yeah, he's saying that the government had put in place a range of measures to help students, but acknowledged that the current crisis with accessing accommodation as they return to campus. In the immediate here and now, it is challenging, he said. We acknowledge that there are limits to what we can do, but we're going to explore any options that are there potentially to help students. Like, that's pretty weak now for people who are out there at their wits' end, no idea of how they're going to get through this term.
Yeah, and the prices are extortionate. And I mean, it affects Dublin disproportionately, but it would affect my own hometown of Waterford, it affects Galway, it affects Cork as well. I just want to return just to the issue of vacancy. Mm-hmm. And just Minister Donoghue did say in the Dáil last night, so they were going to gather information, and I know the opposition will say, well, this should happen quickly, the vacant property tax, but to gather the information by November with a view to bring forward a vacant.
Is it not quite shocking?
But
given
we do have
the
to
number
understand
of times in this studio alone that we've been talking about vacant properties over the last number of years, that we are in 2021 saying we need to gather information.
But we do need to gather information. So, you know, that horrible phrase, we are where we are, and I'm answerable for this government's housing policy, but not for previous government's housing policy. But we don't know where they are. And I do think there's a huge problem with vacancy and dereliction. I think it speaks very strongly to our Town Centres First strategy, which is about trying to identify those properties and bring them back into use. And I absolutely believe that we should be taxing vacant properties. We shouldn't allow properties that are so badly needed in the middle of a housing crisis to lie empty. But we do, while we would all like to fix the problem right here, right now, we do have to gather that information and make an assessment from that point. And that, I suppose, is the hard slog of government, that it would be easy maybe from the opposition benches to say, well, let's do it right now. We don't have the information to introduce it right now.
Well, yeah, but to be fair to the opposition, it's a fair cop in fairness to say, why in God's name do we not have this information? Why at this stage of the game are we this far behind the curve on this?
Yeah, and that's what I'd say. I'm not answerable for previous governments, but I would say this government needs to gather that information in order to bring that forward.
Yeah, I mean, one of the contributors, I think Breach might have referred earlier on to a piecemeal approach. And it seems to me that there, in terms of planning, there seems to be a mismatch between government policy and the actual needs of people who need housing. So if you look at all the big developments of the past 5 or 6 years, you're talking about student accommodation, which is a big glut. That addressed a particular niche, but it didn't address a need. And then we had the controversy with all the REITs who are building apartments to rent at a huge rate, but they all seem to be 1 and 2 bedroom apartments that are geared towards single people rather than to families. And I think what the government's approach should be, just looking at it from outside, is that you identify the need and then you tailor all the packages to address that particular need, rather than allowing the market to dictate where and how it builds.
When it comes to student accommodation, is there another issue here? Because, I mean, like across the road from here, UCD campus, if anyone has ever taken a stroll around there in recent years, it is staggering the amount of student accommodation that has been built there over the last number of years. And it clearly is part of the business model of colleges now because of, presumably because the other sources of revenue aren't there for colleges. And this is part of the business model now that you become an education establishment that needs this income stream from these very expensive accommodations
that are coming from abroad.
Yes.
Because a student coming from abroad might pay €25,000 per annum here, which is a huge amount of money for us. But compared to the prices that they'll pay in the States or Canada, it's kind of minuscule. So it's worth their while to pay that premium price. But there is an injustice there, according to a lot of people.
And the key issue here is that, you know, there's a view out there that there has been no building going on over the last number of years. There has, right? So there's been student accommodation, and Harry's spot on, right? There's been student accommodation in the area that I'm based in Dublin Central. We've seen student accommodation, we've seen applications for co-living, some which have got through, and we have now built to rent, right? And, you know, Mark talks about taking responsibility for this current government. Well, we have seen a decision by this current government to exclude the stamp duty increases on apartments and particularly where the most apartments are going to be built in Dublin City. And we have now seen developers, right? Why would they bother building a conventional apartment when they can build a substandard build to rent apartment, giving the community no opportunity, no household an opportunity to buy? And of course, going back to that issue earlier, Katie, that you articulated about keeping rents elevated. So there's a very real issue here about housing policy and what is being built. Like when I look at my own area, there's 4,500 co-living student or built-to-rent units going through the planning system or under construction at the moment, relative to 2,500 conventional apartments. And that is a reflection of the huge imbalance in this part of Dublin alone, just in terms of what is being built and the failure to meet the needs of those who actually need housing.
Can you just respond to that? Then we'll move on. Mark?
Yeah, so I would go back to Harry's point about the one and two bedroom apartments, that there is absolutely a need for one and two bedroom apartments. And if you look at any of the social housing lists up and down the country, and actually Waterford Council has had a great deal of success with repairing these.
But can I just put you, not one and two bed apartments that are costing the kind of rent levels that we see has gone up in Dublin over the last couple of years.
There is a supply side issue with that. They are much too expensive to rent. They're much too expensive to buy. But we need to build. We need to build at scale. We need to put in factors
I'm interested in knowing what is the point of building apartments that are completely unaffordable unless you are on like mega buck salaries?
No, the affordability issue needs to be addressed in it. But there is no doubt that there's an absolute need for increased density. There's an absolute need for one and two bedroom apartments. I do agree with Harry. Something that we don't do at all well in this country is build family apartments within city centres, within our urban centres.
Could you address Marie's point, which is that the planning system, because of the current rules that are in place, it encourages people to go for the biggest cost centre, the biggest profit centre, which is the lowest spec apartments.
Yeah, and I accept that point, and I accept the point that there were too many of that student type accommodation built, because you can expect developers to go where the most profit is.
Yeah.
And there is absolutely a role for government to point, and as Harry is referring to in terms of planning, to point developers in the way that the state wants them to build. They will, of course, have a profit motive at all times, and I'm sure Breed would address that as well. And it is the role of the state to make sure that the type of planning permissions that are given out, the type of building that's happening, is appropriate. Okay. It is the type of building we need.
OK, we'll leave that one there. I want to move on because the Taoiseach and Fine Gael's Richard Bruton both appeared at the joint Oireachtas Committee on Enterprise, Trade and Employment today to talk about some of the issues surrounding the EU-Canada Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, or CETA, as we will be calling it, which Ireland has yet to ratify. Harry, can you give us a very brief outline of you know what CETA is about and why is it so controversial?
Yeah, okay.
And I did say brief.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much for that. Well, it's essentially, it's a comprehensive economic trade agreement between Canada, cuddly Canada, and Ireland.
What could possibly go wrong?
Yes, I'm being facetious there. And it's it's very long. It took many years of negotiations and it was agreed several years ago. And what's happening at the moment is that 14 or 15 of the 27 EU countries have ratified it. It came up in the Dáil for ratification before Christmas. Several Green Party TDs signalled that they weren't able to support it. So it was kicked back into touch and it has been considered by the Oireachtas Committee on European Affairs for the past couple of months. They have prepared a report on it, which isn't much good to anybody because the committee is hopelessly divided, 7-4 and 7 against CETA. So they're not going to make any recommendation.
And it's been considered by the courts as well.
Yes, Patrick Costello from the Green Party took a challenge against it, which was turned down by the High Court, but he may appeal it. And there's also another possible challenge as well. So I don't think it's going to come back before the Dáil anytime soon. I think they're going to wait for that process to be exhausted. But that issue is this investor relations court. It's a kind of a dispute resolution system that's done by arbitration. And those who oppose it say that the decision of the arbiter will be final and won't be appealable.
And it will override national...
Yeah, within an Irish court. And the other thing is that they say that it will have a chilling effect because if a state promulgates a law that's beneficial in terms of the environment, in terms of public health, if it affects the profits of a particular Canadian company, there is latitude there for them to take a case and perhaps look for compensation from the government. And those who oppose it claim that that avenue is open to them. Those who support it say that that is not going to happen. Okay. The chance of it happening is very marginal indeed.
Okay. Mark Ocasek, what side are you on this?
Yeah, I'm an unlikely cheerleader for international trade agreements of this type.
However, and of this one in particular?
No, in fact, not of this one in particular. I think this is much less problematic, for example, than Mercosur. One of my issues, and Harry was talking, it's an absolutely an enormous trade agreement. And one of my issues around it is about the democratic mandate that allows governments to enter into these type of trade agreements because they take so long to deliver. They take 15, 20 years to deliver. And the world that we live in, the reality we live in, and particularly with respect to climate change and our understanding of the need for climate action, is radically different than when governments gave the mandate to enter into this. Now, what I would say is we are already substantially trading under roughly 98% of CETA.
So what do we need to ratify it?
We do need to ratify it.
Why?
If we're to continue, because otherwise we have to unpick the entire agreement. These are enormous agreements. The final component within it, the one that needs to be ratified, is exactly the one that Harry referred to, which is the investor court system. And that's the problematic one.
Now, we're not alone here. We're one of 13 EU countries that have yet to ratify.
Yes, but that's because people are going through their different ratification procedures. And I would say it has been ratified by Greens in government in other countries. So Luxembourg is an example of that. I would say that the use of the ICS is very, very limited. I just have the correct wording here.
This is the investor court.
Investor court system. It says... So it has to be very, very specific cases around denial of justice, fundamental breach of due process, or through targeted discrimination, for example, of the grounds of race, religious belief, or of gender. So it's only in the case that a company doesn't feel like they have legitimate recourse to the courts within the land. So we can see, perhaps, if we look to the east of Europe and if we look to Hungary in particular, you could see a situation whereby somebody is discriminated against on the grounds of gender or on the grounds of sexuality, that wouldn't even be consistent with European law and our own belief systems. And that a company may feel they would not get a fair hearing in the courts of the land. And it's only in that very type of very specific instance that they'll have recourse to the ICS.
I'm confused now. Why would a
you can join the club?
As well. I'd like to ask Mark, to put it up to him there, because he said he's an unlikely cheerleader, and to be honest with you, if I wasn't sitting down, I'd have fallen down and broke the other leg listening to a Green Party deputy who got elected on the response by the Irish population to the need to act on the climate catastrophe that we're facing.
Yeah.
And Mark will know that up and down the globe, giant fossil fuel corporations are suing states for any attempt to legislate
Not under this provision. So that's a false analogy.
Likely cheerleader for a deal that would contain a huge element of investor court system into it, that would stop a government from protecting their environment in the interest of dealing with the climate catastrophe. And to say that, I think it's unbelievable. It really beggars belief that the Greens would even consider supporting CETA. And I say fair play to Patrick Costello for trying through the courts, but it needs to go much further than that. There's huge opposition to this, that any state would sign up to a deal to weaken our ability to be able to regulate and legislate around the environment or any other issue indeed. For example, Paul Murphy today highlighted one area that could have serious consequences, where a real estate investment trust could sue if we legislate to protect renters or to freeze rents. That's a real possibility. And this is a pivotal moment for us. And I'd just like to come back on Harry that I don't think they're going to leave it sit there, because just a couple of hours ago, we got a notice from the Oireachtas of a motion from the chair of the Joint Committee on European Affairs that Dáil Éireann will take note of the report of the Joint Committee of the that was laid before the House on the 15th of September. Now, we have to vote on that motion. But what we in the opposition benches have been saying, and the Green Party would have been saying is, if they were in opposition, that it's not enough just for the Committee on European Affairs to examine this deal. The Climate Committee needs to examine it, and other interested committees need to examine what's going on here.
Okay.
And just for one committee to be left to the examination to lay that report is not good enough.
Okay.
And
okay.
Let me put this going ahead.
Let me put some of that to Mark Breed. It was Green Party policy that we would not ratify CETA.
No, it wasn't. In fact, but we had an issue with when, again, we're going into the weeds here. But when was the ISDS, so the Investor State Dispute System? If that's the correct S at the end, that was much more problematic. And we advocated, in fact, up to a European level, we advocated for a change in that. And that's when it changed to the ICS. I will say, just in relation to what Breed was saying there, so 2019, the European Court of Justice found that the ICS is compatible with European law. In 2018, the EU and Canada said it would comply with the Paris Agreement.
So if we just not
this
use
is,
the...
This is important, though, on the specific ICS, the charge.
I know, Joe, but I'm just saying, we're talking about the investor court system. You're saying that that can't be used to legislate or to sue on the basis of profit loss to do with climate change legislation.
So from Chapter 24, and I went looking for it today, it says explicitly it protects each side's right to regulate on environmental matters. And then Article 24.5, the parties recognise that it is inappropriate to encourage trade or investment by weakening or reducing the levels of protection afforded in their environmental law. So
what about
specifically to that?
What about the issue that was raised today with Paul Murphy? And I think we have, do we have that clip of the Thánaiste responding on this issue about whether or not there could be a lawsuit in relation to protecting tenants' rent control?
Are we not going to be in a position in a few years' time if we sign up to CETA where we will be saying, OK, we need rent controls to bring rents down to an affordable level? And you, if you're still in government, hopefully not at that time, will say not only, oh, it's unconstitutional, but you'll also say if we do that, we may be sued for indirect expropriation by the company in the investor court system.
Yeah, I think there's two things there, Deputy. First of all, is whether or not it's constitutional.
Sure, exactly.
That would have to be determined by the Supreme Court, presumably. The second question is, would there have to be compensation in those circumstances? I think any company could argue in such a scenario that this represents confiscation or expropriation, and that case would have to be heard.
But the point being, they could sue us, not in the Irish courts, but in this special investor court system, which, as you've accepted, is a parallel justice system simply set up for corporations.
They can sue us in either, Deputy.
So, Mark Ocasek, they could sue us in this parallel justice system in those circumstances.
They could sue us if, in very specific circumstances, as I went to in the start, with if it's a fundamental breach of due process, if it's discrimination on grounds of race, religious belief or gender. Companies already have recourse to a legal system, be it the Irish courts or wherever. It's the use of the ICS is very specific, very limited.
Okay, Marie.
The Thánaiste, so, who's the Minister for Trade, has said they could sue us in those circumstances, and they could sue us in the investor courts, and they would be entitled to compensation in every likelihood. He also said that we could be left behind by the rest of the European Union in the ratification of CETA, and he thinks that we'd be out on a limb. But he'd no issue on us being left out in the limb with the rest of the world when it comes to defending corporation taxes. I mean, these people are just unbelievable. And what's more unbelievable is the likes of Mark or anybody in the Green Party defending it. It's just breathtaking. The people need to know what's going on here without having to listen to complicated mechanisms and legislation. What's going on here is that giant global corporations are trying to gain control of all the natural resources and political spheres where vast profits can be made. And that includes property, but it is mostly about fossil fuel corporations and anybody who has a hand, act or part in trying to do things to the environment that will make their profits. We can't protect that environment.
You don't accept what Mark has just said there, that it specifically excludes issues related to climate targets?
Well, it doesn't specifically exclude issues related to climate targets when it comes to the giant fossil fuel corporations who are currently suing in these investor courts.
Not in this investor court. So that's a false analogy. She's talking about the Energy Charter Treaty. That is not the ICS.
So
we're not comparing like with like.
Supposing the bill I have next week was to ban the development of liquefied natural gas terminals across this country, are you telling me that if we were signed up to CETA, that Fortress Energy would not, or a Canadian-related company, would not have the ability to challenge us in court? Or indeed, that the fact that those courts exist, as was said earlier, does not offer a chill factor over the government and over the actions that we take in terms of our legislation?
Okay, let Mark respond to that, then I'm going to let
Look, as I said, I'm an unlikely cheerleader for the agreements of this type. However, I am content that there's sufficient protection for Irish interests within the course of this law. What we're being asked to believe by the likes of Breed and others, that the other countries who have ratified this have chosen to ratify an agreement that is damaging to them in some ways. And we're also choosing, by the way, to believe that the Canadian government is also signing up to an agreement whereby an Irish company could sue them under this ICS system. So I just don't find that tenable to believe. I think that we're sufficiently protected in terms of, particularly in terms of environmental law, which is the one that Breed was driving at. And I think for that reason, and the other
I'm watching the clock, Mark. I'm sorry. I want to let Marie in on this because I want to move on to a couple of last things.
Yeah, and I was actually at that hearing today at the Joint Oireachtas Commission on Enterprise, Trade and Employment. And I suppose what I'm intrigued hearing now is listening to Mark's interpretation of the investor court system and how different that was to the Taoiseach's interpretation of the investor court system today, where he very much just portrayed it as an alternative to the domestic courts and in some ways just a more efficient system for corporates to sue each other or indeed sue the state. So like ultimately here we have a serious question to ask. There have been trade deals conducted by the European Union with Japan, with China, indeed partially with Britain last year, that had no investor court system in those trade deals. And you know, the question has to be asked, why is that the case, and yet we're being told we have to sign up to this under the CETA agreement? The Taoiseach today talked about, you know, Ireland being I suppose a laggard, and he wanted us to be ahead of the other member states in terms of ratifying this. There are 13 other member states who have very serious concerns with regards to ratification of this, and I think the question has to be asked now as to whether it'll ever be ratified.
There are 13 other member states but can you specify a country that has outlined a serious particular concerns?
Absolutely.
Aside from Malta,
Italy and France at the moment, and Germany and the Netherlands, and there's a very real risk.
The
question was asked of the Taoiseach today, what conversations have taken place at EU level with regards to ratifying CETA without the investor court system? And of course, we got no clarity on that.
Okay, I want to move on. There's only a couple of minutes left. I do want to ask you, Mark, because we were talking there about division in the Green Party. Your party colleague, Nessa Horrigan, was in with us on Thursday night. She expressed concern that the Green Party hadn't discussed issues around those derogatory comments that were made in a WhatsApp group that Deputy Brian Leddon was a member of. She was saying that there was no discussion of that.
In fact, the Tuesday of our thinking, we had a session chaired by my constituency colleague, Grace O'Sullivan, where we spoke about dignity and respect and the need to update our dignity and respect protocols. Our General Secretary outlined some 22 specific actions that our wider organisation has undertaken in order to promote dignity and respect within the Green Party.
So you're happy that it was appropriately discussed at...
I think our party and every other party and every other part of society has an ongoing job of work to make sure that we treat people within, I suppose, our political parties, within the political system and within our wider society fairly.
Just to say, one of the women who had comments made about them was in touch with us here on this programme after last Thursday night. This is the professional woman who says she has no political connections. Brian Lennon, presumably tongue-in-cheek, proposed her name for the profile photo for the group, and he didn't object when another member of the WhatsApp group put her photo up as the profile photo with a very derogatory, misogynistic word, the C word, written across this woman's face. She says she has never received an apology. Do you think she should receive that apology?
I'm afraid in this instance I have to give you a very beige and very political answer. This is subject to legal scrutiny at the moment. And as such, because it's a legal matter at this point, I'm more than happy to discuss dignity and respect within the Green Party generally, but not this specific instance.
Okay, I'm going to leave that there. As it's a legal issue, as I say, we're not going to open that up to a wider discussion. A one-line answer on this one then. Fine Gael put up a tweet yesterday saying, how should we commemorate the COVID-19 pandemic? I said, should we commemorate the COVID? Might be a better question. But the choices that they offered were time off for frontline workers, monetary gift for frontline workers, or something else. Harry?
I think a monetary gift for frontline workers would probably be the most practical thing. And the most practical way of showing our appreciation towards them. But it should be defined widely what a frontline worker is.
I was just going to say, Marie, can you define a frontline worker for us?
Absolutely. Well, is it obviously health workers? And I know that conversation has started, but we need to talk about retail workers. We need to talk about waste collection. We need to talk about Gardaí. You know, there's a whole raft of workers out there. They'll be easily identified when you look at the revenue records of who was actually working and not working during that time. So we need to see a cash payment to those in respect of the contribution that they made last year and this year.
And broadcasters, of course.
And broadcasters, well, you know. Although the broadcasters were working from home, so that's a difference.
Some of them were.
It's a hell of a difficult question for a one-line answer. I would say as well, I think there should be some sort of a COVID dividend for our younger people who suffered disproportionately. Lives just absolutely put on hold. No discos, no dates for 2 years. And I think in thinking about how we commemorate COVID, I'm uncomfortable with that word, but when we think about that, I think there should be a COVID dividend to our younger people.
Yes. Can I just make
very
a quick
quickly
comment?
Breed, we're actually out of time.
It's amazing how we find it difficult to talk about these things or make decisions on them, and other states, including Northern Ireland, have gone ahead and given lump sum payments to frontline workers, to health workers, and have recognised that during COVID we realised as a society, who do we really rely on? Not politicians, not broadcasters, we rely on workers. And they are the drivers of the buses, the shop workers, the nurses, the porters, the cleaners. And we need to show them that we care and stop clapping them and give them some money and some time off.
Okay, Breed Smith, many thanks for that. And thanks to all my panel for coming in tonight. That's all we have time for. The producer tonight was Penny Hart. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The BCO was Elaine Conlon, and Mark McGrath was on sound. Up next, it's Colm Murray with Late Date. But first, we'll hand over to Adrian Eames on the Sports Desk.